This act flows from a clear and simple wrong. Its only purpose is to right that wrong. Millions of Americans are denied the right to vote because of their color. This law will ensure them the right to vote. The wrong is one which no American in his heart can justify. The right is one which no American, true to our principles, can deny.
There have been countless books written about the civil rights movement. Far less attention has been paid to what happened after the dramatic passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 and the turbulent forces it unleashed. The new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, by journalist Ari Berman, tells this story. Berman charts both the transformation of American democracy under the Voting Rights Act, as well as the counter-revolution that has sought to limit voting rights from 1965 up to the present day. Ari Berman is a contributing writer for The Nation and an investigative journalist fellow at The Nation Institute, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable once again. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me back, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. Again, the name of the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. What led you to this subject?
Well, I started reporting on voting rights early in 2011 when I noticed that all these states had changed their voting laws, in my view, to make it harder to vote. So things like shutting down voter registration drives, cutting early voting, requiring a government-issued ID that you never needed before to cast a ballot, making it so that ex-felons couldn't vote. And this was happening all across the country in places like Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, Texas. And so I thought to myself, this must be a national trend. And I wrote my first story about it for Rolling Stone, which got a lot of attention. And then what happened after that is that more states started passing new restrictions. Laws were being challenged in court. And so I covered the 2012 election through the lens of voting rights and who would and wouldn't be able to participate. And then after the 2012 election, the Supreme Court decided to hear a challenge to the Voting Rights Act. And I got very interested in the history of the Voting Rights Act, and I started asking around about what books I should read to get up to speed on what the Voting Rights Act did. And I was kind of surprised that no one had written really a comprehensive account of the Voting Rights Act. And I knew we were coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and I knew that voting rights had been a big issue in recent years. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I should write this book. And so, long story short, that's how we got here.
One of the things that I find very interesting about this story that you tell in the book is that the backlash to the law was immediate. It did not take a second for there to be backlash to the law.
It really was immediate, and that was kind of the most surprising thing that I learned in doing the research, was just how intense the resistance was over a 50-year period. LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, when he passed the Voting Rights Act, hoped that this would end the debate over voting rights once and for all. Remember, we had passed a 15th Amendment in 1870 that was supposed to end the problem of racial discrimination in voting, and it was because we ignored the 15th Amendment for 90 years that we had to pass the Voting Rights Act in 1965. So I think people were hopeful that the federal government really had the power to solve this problem once and for all. And they did have the power. They had the power to strike down literacy tests, to register thousands and then millions of voters, to monitor elections, to force those states with the worst voting changes, with the worst histories of voting discrimination, to approve their voting changes with the federal government. The problem was that the resistance was so intense from the beginning. And every time the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act was upheld, or every time that the law was reauthorized by Congress, and it was reauthorized four times, there was a new form of opposition. The opposition to it morphed. And so what you see now with the Supreme Court striking down the Voting Rights Act and the Congress being unwilling now to do anything about it, and all these new states passing new voting restrictions, is that really this counter-revolution of voting rights has kind of reached a fever pitch.
Talk a little bit about what you just mentioned, and that is the reauthorization. It was reauthorized by Congress four times: 1970, 1975, 1982, and as recent as 2006. Why were those reauthorizations necessary, and ultimately what did they accomplish and allow as when it comes to opposition?
Well, I think the both LBJ and the Congress had hoped that 5 years would be enough for the most important provisions of the Voting Rights Act, that by 1970 they would have registered enough voters and that there wouldn't be a need for a Voting Rights Act in 1970. The problem was, as I mentioned, that the resistance to the law was much more intense than people anticipated, and also it just took a lot longer to strike down all these discriminatory election systems to get minority candidates, not just not minority voters, not just registered, but also then to have them actually run for office and win. That took many decades. And so the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized, as you mentioned, first in 1970. That reauthorization also lowered the voting age to 18 and abolished literacy tests nationwide. And so the Voting Rights Act was something that became the prime vehicle for expanding voting rights for a lot of people. In 1975, the act was reauthorized again, and that act expanded protections for language minority groups, so Hispanics, Asian Americans, Native Americans, they were all protected under the VRA. It wasn't just for African Americans. And then in 1982, it was reauthorized again, and that law made it easier to try to strike down election systems that prevented minority candidates from winning office. And then, as I mentioned again, it was reauthorized in 2006 during the Bush administration. And what's interesting is that every reauthorization was signed by Republican presidents and was passed with overwhelmingly support by Republicans in Congress. I think a lot of people think of the Voting Rights Act as a Democratic, a liberal piece of legislation, but it's always had strong Republican support.
Why is that the case, and why then is there such concern when it comes to the right and our political right, and as far as giving people equal rights in voting?
Well, I think either members of the Republican Party actually believed in the Voting Rights Act and thought it was consistent with them being the party of Lincoln. I think we've seen that over five decades. I also think that there were Republicans who were worried that if they didn't support the Voting Rights Act, it would hurt their status, not just with African-American voters, but with progressive whites, with other constituencies. The problem in recent years is that particularly following Obama's election, when you had this huge turnout of African-Americans, Hispanics, younger voters, is that elements of the Republican Party don't think they can win those voters anymore. So instead, they've decided to try to make it harder for some of those people to participate. What you've seen is that the Republican Party itself has become a lot whiter, a lot more conservative, and a lot more Southern than it was before, both in terms of demographics and in ideology. And so unfortunately, the Republican Party, which has always been supportive of the Voting Rights Act, has now become a lot more hostile to the act. Republicans in Congress don't really see a need for it anymore, and the conservative justices on the Supreme Court have shifted radically to the right since the Voting Rights Act was authorized in 1965.
You do write in the book, and I'm wondering how much of a turning point this was during the Reagan administration, and you talk about John Roberts, who at this point was an ambitious young conservative. He was working in the Justice Department under Ronald Reagan and was well known for writing memos criticizing the Voting Rights Act. Was there a turning point in that time as these young conservatives came of age?
Well, Reagan was a huge turning point. Reagan himself. I mean, Reagan was someone who opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He opposed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and he opposed the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And no Republican president had ever taken those stands before. I mean, Reagan was essentially a Goldwater Republican, and then Goldwater got crushed in 1964. So for Reagan to come back 16 years later with essentially the same platform on civil rights as Goldwater, and instead of losing 44 states, to win 44 states, was a dramatic turnaround for the Republican Party. And what you see is a lot of young ideologues followed Reagan to Washington, people like John Roberts, and opposition to the civil rights laws of the 1960s was a signature cause for them. And you see people like John Roberts coming of age politically at this time, arguing that things like the Voting Rights Act are going to lead to affirmative action in the electoral sphere, or they're going to lead to quotas in electoral politics. And so fast forward to 2013, when Justice Scalia famously calls the Voting Rights Act a perpetuation of racial entitlement. He is, in most blunt terms, arguing the Reagan ideology on civil rights. And indeed, if you look at the five conservative justices on the Supreme Court who gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, they were all either appointed by Reagan or they worked for Reagan. So there definitely would not have been a dismantling of the Voting Rights Act had it not been for the Reagan administration and its influence on conservatism over the preceding decades.
Do you think John Roberts' views have changed over time? They have morphed, they have matured?
It really doesn't seem like it. I mean, he has made the same arguments on the court that he essentially made as a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department. I think Roberts made up his mind. He was very bright. He made up his mind in the 1980s, first when he clerked for Justice William Rehnquist, who was the most conservative member on the court when it came to civil rights issues, and then when he worked for Reagan. And by all accounts, those have been his views ever since. And he told the Congress, interestingly enough, that he didn't have any problems with the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. But what you see from Roberts when he gets on the court, first when there's a 2009 challenge to the Voting Rights Act, and then again when there's a 2013 challenge to the Voting Rights Act, is that he's uniquely hostile to this law. And on a broader scheme, he's uniquely hostile to efforts to try to redress historic instances of discrimination, things like affirmative action. He just does not like these policies. He has major ideological problems with them. And I think his signature project on the court has been to try to limit the power of the civil rights laws of the 1960s.
And Samuel Alito comes into this as well.
He comes into this as well. Alito is, you know, as ideological, if not more ideological, than Roberts. They both work in the Reagan administration together. Roberts works more directly on voting rights, so that's why I write more about him. But certainly Alito is a Reaganite conservative in the same way that Roberts is.
We're talking to Ari Berman. The name of the book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. The book is published by FSG. At what point do you think we are in right now? Is this, as you said, you were looking at our most recent election, and certainly after 2000 there were great concerns as to who was voting, and yet, at least as you point out in the book, and it seems over the last 15 years, not a lot has happened.
Not a lot has happened since the disaster of Florida in 2000, and in fact, we've moved in the wrong direction. Many more states have passed new laws making it harder to vote since Florida 2000, including Florida, unfortunately, which had seven-hour lines on Election Day 2012 because they cut early voting and eliminated voting on the Sunday before the election and did similar things. And so I think we've unfortunately learned many of the wrong lessons from the 2000 recount debacle. I think far too many states have made it harder to vote in terms of easier to vote. I think it's unfortunate that on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, the Supreme Court has both gutted the Voting Rights Act and the Congress, which has historically stepped in to protect voting rights over a five-year period, instead is unwilling to do anything about it. And so I think this backlash against voting rights that I write a lot about in my book, we are living this backlash right now in many ways. What we've seen throughout American history is that when there's been very dramatic progress on civil rights, things like Reconstruction, for example, they've always been followed by a major backlash. And Obama's election, to me, was one of those incredible moments on civil rights when people thought that this issue was finally settled. And what we saw is that not only was it not settled, but that the historic progress we made sparked an even more aggressive backlash.
Bring us back to 2000 and what happened during that election. You talk in the book about this voter purge that ultimately became botched during the election that was overseen by Jeb Bush that prevented African Americans from voting and ultimately, you point out, helped George W. Bush win the White House.
Well, this was a really big turning point when it came to restricting voting rights because, as you mentioned earlier, there was this massive voter purge that was drawn up by the state of Florida, the run-up to the 2000 election. They essentially said that tens of thousands of felons were illegally on the voting rolls, and Florida was one of those states where ex-felons couldn't vote. And so they said that the county election supervisors had to purge the voting rolls. The problem was twofold. Number one, that the list was extremely inaccurate. It wasn't strict enough, so a lot of people who weren't felons were labeled felons. And then secondly, it had a discriminatory character. African Americans were 11% of registered voters in Florida, but 44% of the purge list. So on election day 2000, when all these people are turned away from the polls and wrongly labeled as felons, they're disproportionately African Americans who are turned away. That's problematic for two reasons. Number one, because that likely violated the Voting Rights Act. And number two, because we know that African American voters in Florida voted overwhelmingly for Al Gore, 90% for Al Gore. And so when you're talking about an election that was 537 votes, this voter purge clearly could have cost Al Gore the election, because we knew after the election that 12,000 voters were wrongly labeled as felons. We don't know how many of them tried to vote, but we do know that that was a number far in excess of George W. Bush's margin of victory. The other consequence of the Florida election, it wasn't only that I think some elements of the Republican Party realized that they could get away with this stuff, that small manipulations in the electoral process would make a big difference. But it also empowered a new Bush administration, which fixated on voter fraud instead of investigating voter disenfranchisement efforts. That's still with us today in all the rhetoric we hear about voter fraud, even though there's not really much evidence of voter fraud. It also allowed George W. Bush to appoint two justices to the Supreme Court, Sam Alito and John Roberts, who, of course, were instrumental in then gutting the Voting Rights Act.
As you say, it's hard to know and it's hard to say, but I'm curious, the title of the book is Give Us the Ballot. Who is us? Who is being deprived of the ballot right now?
Well, that phrase, give us the ballot, comes from a famous speech that Martin Luther King gave in 1957. It was his first major speech about voting rights at the Lincoln Memorial, and this was obviously before his famous I Have a Dream speech. It was 8 years before the Voting Rights Act, and when he was talking about give us the ballot, he was talking about obviously enfranchising millions of African Americans who are disenfranchised in the South. But when I think of give us the ballot, I mean, I think of it as a much broader term in terms of, you know, enfranchising all people, but one that remains, I think, very relevant today, both not just, you know, King's speech, but this whole notion of people still fighting for voting rights.
But is there a sector of our society? How random is it, or how programmed is it, as to who is being affected by the lapses and the problems with the Voting Rights Act?
Well, if you look at the constituencies that are most impacted, I mean, they're clearly the constituencies that voted in largest numbers for President Obama. And what Republicans are trying to do in passing these new restrictions is to make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative instead of younger, more diverse, and more progressive. So younger voters, African Americans, Hispanics, Asian Americans, I mean, I think all these groups are disproportionately impacted by these laws. I think there are some elements of the Republican Party, Republican base, that are also impacted by these laws. I think elderly voters, for example, maybe some voters with disabilities, they are also certainly impacted by these things because they're less mobile. They may not, for example, have driver's licenses anymore. They may need more time to vote and rely on things like early voting. So I do think that it's not just Democrats who are impacted by these changes, not just progressive voters or voters of color, but I do think those voters are disproportionately impacted by the changes.
I think it's toward the end of the book you make this statement. I think it's really interesting about reminding us of history, where there were African Americans who just gave up, who said, okay, this isn't going to happen. Do you think people are giving up now? Do you think people are
saying, what do you mean in terms of giving up?
If you're going back in our history, when blacks, even women, were looking for the rights to vote, that it was so difficult that there was, okay, we're going to give up.
Yeah. I don't know if it was that they so much gave up or that they didn't have a choice. I mean, things like literacy tests were administered in such a way that they were so discriminatory that even you had, you know, black PhD professors who couldn't pass them, and they were violently prevented from voting. So I'm not sure so much as people gave up as that they both through legal means and also through violent means were prevented from participating. I think today what we saw in the 2012 election with efforts to make it more difficult to vote is that there was a backlash against them, and you actually saw black turnout increase with President Obama on the ballot, not just nationally, but also in key swing states like Ohio, where there were efforts to make it harder to vote. I do worry about that happening going forward, though, because we already have such low voter turnout in this country that I do think that people are going to be discouraged and people are going to stay away from the process because they think it's too difficult or they can't comply with the new regulations. And what we saw in states like Texas and North Carolina that had these new restrictions in place in the last election is that people were turned away from voting, that we had some real data on this now. And so I'm concerned that it's going to happen again in 2016. I'm not sure that there's always going to be these Herculean organizing efforts to get people to the polls. I do worry that our already dismal voter turnout numbers will go down even further if we don't do something about trying to fix this problem.
You talk about states with obstacles, and Florida, of course, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. You mentioned North Carolina. Are there states to look at with great promise that are doing a good job?
Well, I think you're seeing that some of the blue states are doing a good job. Oregon just passed automatic voter registration, so anyone who interacts with the DMV office then is automatically registered to vote, and it's up to them to opt out. And that's potentially transformative, because if you did that nationally, you would add 50 million new voters to the rolls. And we know once people are registered, they're much more likely to participate. California is thinking about adopting the same kind of automatic voter registration. They have online voter registration there. They're doing a lot of good things. I would love to see New York become more of a leader on this issue. I think it's sad that we are such a progressive state, but yet we don't have early voting. We don't have same-day voter registration. I think that more states like New York should be more aggressive about expanding voter access, particularly because it's being cut back in so many other states.
Well, the name of the book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It is published by FSG. Ari Berman is a contributing writer for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. Ari Berman, thank you very much for joining us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much, Joe. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It is published by FSG. Ari Berman is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.